A new academic year has begun in South Carolina, and with it, changes are coming to schools across the Palmetto State. Who better to talk about the changes than the superintendent of education in the state of South Carolina? Today, on the Palmetto Family Matters show, Ellen Weaver joins Dr. Steve Pettit for a thoughtful conversation on the state of education in our state.
Well, Ellen, thank you so much for being with us today in our little humble office here. Thank you for taking the time out.
My pleasure. Great to be here.
And we're excited for you and the work that you're doing for South Carolina in the realm of education. Of course, I've been in education some in South Carolina, so this is a very, very big deal, and you have a very important role. So thank you so much. Obviously, these are a hot topic today in education. Cell phones in classrooms here in South Carolina, not only here but across the nation, they're basically trying to ban the use of them, widespread use of smartphones. Tell us about that.
Yeah, well, as I have traveled around the state, talking with teachers, talking with students, talking with administrators, one of the themes that just keeps surfacing over and over and over again is a real struggle with lack of discipline in schools and in classrooms. And, you know, teaching and teachers are the number one in-school determiner of how and what a student learns.
Right.
And so we want to retain the best and the brightest teachers here in South Carolina. And what teachers have told me is that, you know, of course, they'd like to be paid more money. And
sure,
we're making progress on that front here in South Carolina. Over the last 6 years, we've actually taken our starting teacher salary from $32,000 in 2018-19 to $47,000
okay,
this year, which is a massive leap forward.
It's going up.
It's going up. But as important as that is, what I hear from teachers is that they don't feel safe in their classroom, and that they don't feel like they have the attention of the students. Mm. And those devices, that cell phone that you just held up, is a big contributor to that, because not only is it distracting children from the educational purpose that they're there at school to achieve, but in many cases, it is actually used for cyberbullying.
Wow.
There are fights that are being filmed at school, staged fights, kids feeling like, as one superintendent told me, they're creating their own reality TV show.
Wow.
And so there's all kinds of potential for illicit drug use that is facilitated by phones. So, I mean, these phones really are a gateway to the worst of the internet. I even know students who sadly have been shown just filth on their phone by other students, things that no child should ever see.
Right.
And so I truly believe that getting a hold of this technology is not only the right thing to do for the well-being of students, but also for the retention of our teachers. Our teachers want to be able to teach. And, you know, as I think about the larger ramifications of this cell phone policy, I can't help but think of, you know, as a person of faith, talking to a person
right,
of faith,
right,
we were made for face-to-face communication.
Right, right.
And these devices that we hold in our hand, we have never been more connected and yet more disconnected.
Absolutely.
From our fellow humans. And
absolutely,
so it's not only about the educational mission, it's not only about retaining our teachers. It's also about encouraging our students to build that person-to-person relational dynamic,
sure,
that they have to be successful.
Which was so natural.
Yes.
You know, when I was growing up, it was very natural. And that was your life, relationships.
That's right.
I've lived long enough to work with 20-somethings now, and they crave the interpersonal relationships that was so natural to me. That, not that I don't desire that, it's just different.
Yeah.
And I can only imagine a child growing up with a cell phone and not going through the discipline processes that it would take to teach them how to properly use that.
Mm-hmm.
And now you take that into the classroom, and you wonder if anybody can learn.
Yeah, and even the brain science behind it. I mean, you know, we know now that what you call our prefrontal cortex, which is really our executive functioning, our ability to control ourselves and our actions, that's not fully formed typically until you're in your early to mid-20s, especially for boys.
Yes. 25 is what I've been told, and I was reminded of that as a college president.
Yes, and so when you have middle schoolers and high schoolers, I mean, we literally are rewiring their brains in the worst possible way. Mm. We have performed a technological experiment on a whole generation of students, and we're paying the societal price for that. Wow. But I have great hope that this policy is a strong first step to start to get a hold of some of that damage.
So just to be clear, cell phones are banned in all schools, all the way up through high school.
Well, so I want to be really clear about the term. Okay. I think banned is a word that has been used a lot by the media. Okay. So what the policy does, it doesn't actually ban the phones. But what it does say is that phones have to be up and away the entirety of the school day. So that means from the first bell to the last bell. And there are a number of ways that districts could choose to comply with that. So that's part of the flexibility that we built into the policy.
So it's a bigger picture.
That's right. Yeah. That's exactly right. And really what I've been trying to encourage our superintendents and schools to talk about is free to focus, as opposed to focusing on what we're taking away from students. What we're giving them is peace of mind. What we're giving them is the freedom to focus on their instruction, on building those friendships that we talked about, and really even on school safety. I often get asked, so, you know, what has been the response of parents to this? And I think in the current climate that we live in, it's very understandable that parents are afraid. The idea that somebody could bring a gun into a school and that's the last time you ever hear from your child. I mean, that's just what an unimaginable horror and terror that is. But what law enforcement tells us is that actually the most important thing in an emergency like that is for a student to be fully focused on the teacher or the adult who's getting them to safety.
That's true.
And those cell phones actually can create a distraction. And so the way that we have crafted this policy, by not prohibiting cell phones from being on campus, but simply saying they have to be off and away, in an emergency situation, the most important thing is to get the student to safety, and then to worry about the communication on the cell phone.
So they come into a class and they have to turn it in when they come in the morning? Is this the way?
That's one way it could be implemented. Some schools are looking at cell phone lockers where they are put up and away the entire day. There's a technology called a Yonder pouch, which is a neoprene pouch that you would drop the phone into. Wow. It snaps shut with a magnetic lock like you would see on a security tag at a retailer.
Wow.
And so some schools have implemented that. So the student keeps the phone with them all day, but it's just locked up. And again, in the case of an emergency, you could have magnets in the classroom that would unlock it. You can actually cut into it with medical scissors. So there would be ways for students to access that device in an emergency. And so we're actually looking at ways that we can help districts pay for that if that's the route that they choose to go. We actually had money in the state budget this year where we could match districts with some of that.
So, and there's a big difference between a senior in high school and a third grader.
Yeah, obviously.
Well, let's move on to another subject.
Okay.
And that's the subject here of school choice, which is, we know, has been a passion that you've had. And for the last two decades, the South Carolina General Assembly has considered various proposals for public and private school choice. Mm-hmm. So let's just stop here and let's let everybody know, what are options for parents today right now in South Carolina?
Absolutely. And let me just preface it briefly by saying the reason I'm so passionate about this is because I have been a beneficiary of choice. So my parents actually sacrificed to put me in a small Christian school, kindergarten to fifth grade. That school closed because of financial concerns when I was in fifth grade. And so mom homeschooled me from sixth to 10th grade. And then I actually graduated from a great public school in 11th and 12th grade. So I've kind of seen the whole spectrum of what was available in the dark ages when I was in school, right?
No, I'm the dark ages. So the dark ages, I grew up here in South Carolina and I went kindergarten through the 12th grade public education.
Okay.
And then I went to a state college, the Citadel. So my whole education is South Carolina in the public system.
Public schools, yeah. So, I mean, as you know, so there's a broad spectrum of opportunity there. And my point in telling you that is just that I firmly believe that every child needs what they need when they need it. And so my parents, thank you for everything that they did to make sure that I had the opportunity I needed. But even looking at my brother and sister, they needed different things than I did. So even within a single family, kids need different things. And that's why I'm so passionate about this. I think a lot of times people seek to portray this conversation as being anti-public education.
Right.
But I think that the truth of the matter is that we are pro-public education in the most expansive sense of that term, meaning we want students to be in the environment that is right for them, wherever that environment is. And that's actually how the rest of the advanced world does schooling. The United States is actually very singular in how we deliver what we call public education. So in terms of the options that are available here in South Carolina right now, I want to start with public education because that is a choice that many families make. Families who have the means to choose where their house is often choose it based on the school system that they want their child to be in. Now, sadly, there are many people in South Carolina that don't have that flexibility to do that. And so they go to their assigned school, whatever the quality of that school.
Right.
So we have public choice here. We have public charter schools that have been growing extensively in South Carolina, both in the rural and the urban context. We have wonderful magnet schools that are within the public school system here in South Carolina. So in a big district like Greenville, they may turn some of their schools into a magnet school. We have some here in Columbia, too.
Wow.
Spring Valley High School has some wonderful magnet programs up in Richland, too.
Okay.
And so those are special programs built around a theme that, that kids can opt into if there's space. Obviously, homeschooling is a wonderful option. We have three different ways to accomplish homeschooling in South Carolina. And then, of course, there's the Education Scholarship Trust Fund that we recently had a disappointing setback on, but we are committed to pushing forward with the future of choice.
So explain that to us. Explain what the, we called it ESA.
Yep.
So explain that and then explain the vote that came across.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, my vision of education in South Carolina is really what I call the education ecosystem of the future. And when you look at what happened during COVID, education, even before COVID, but it was accelerated by COVID, is becoming increasingly unbundled. Just like we saw with phones, just like we saw with cable TV, there is a marketplace of options, and parents want to be able to kind of pick and choose services for their students. And I think during COVID, many parents saw that they had new flexibility to do it. They were forced to do it. Yeah. And so that's what I really see as being kind of the drive of the future. And so the question is how do we set up funding systems that ensure that every student has access to equal opportunity, whatever their income, whatever their zip code? And so,
which is the right thing?
Which is the right thing. Right. That's right. We should fund students, not systems.
Right.
And so, we look at the ESA program here in South Carolina, and ESA is a form of private school choice, although under an ESA, it's really much broader than just school. Parents can purchase therapies, they can purchase tutoring, they can purchase other instructional materials.
Very optional
oriented. It's very options oriented. And ESAs were actually born in Arizona, which has a direct connection to what's happening here in South Carolina, because Arizona had passed a voucher program a number of years ago. They have what is called a Blaine Amendment in their state constitution, which we also have here in South Carolina, which is what that court decision was based on. And so when their voucher program, which would be a direct payment of state funds to private schools, was ruled unconstitutional, they came back and created this ESA mechanism whereby money is deposited into an account that is controlled by parents. It's no longer money of the state. The parent is then allowed to use it for the purposes provided for in the scholarship bill. So that's what an ESA is. We still have the program here in South Carolina, but the recent court decision that came down has said that that cannot be used to pay for tuition at an independent or private school. So that's really the nub of what we're going to be dealing with now, is figuring out what the path forward is, especially for the families who were in the program this first year, who have now
been
told.
And how many would that be, families?
Well, we're, you know, anywhere from 1,000 to 2,000 families. We're still working to calculate the number of students who are actually using that for independent school tuition, because again, there are many ways to use the ESA, including paying for inter-district transfer fees. So say I live in Greenville County and I want to go to school next door in Lawrence County.
Okay.
There's oftentimes a transfer fee to accommodate for the difference in the local tax base between the two school districts. And so ESAs can even be used for that. So we have, I believe, over 20 traditional school districts that are enrolled as service providers in the ESA program. So it really is.
But is that all kind of set aside now?
No, all of that is still legitimate. The only thing that has been struck down has been the use of the funds for that private school tuition.
I see. So give me maybe a comparison. You know, we always work by metrics. What are metrics for this in other states? You know, and it feels kind of, you know, you're trying to avoid rigidity in education versus flexibility. So what are other states doing? Because I hear what other states are doing and I'm thinking we're like a little bit behind the times.
Yeah, I think we really are, especially on this private choice conversation. Like you said, I mean, we've been fighting for two decades to get this across the finish line here. And meanwhile, other states, Arizona, Florida, have massive programs that at this point
Indiana,
have been going on.
Ohio,
Indiana, exactly, for decades, right? And so that's what I just try to encourage people who approach this conversation based on what is really fear-mongering from national teachers unions and other organizations at the national level that want to maintain their grip on power. I mean, that's really what this is about, is power and money, right?
Right.
And they understand that if you open up this education ecosystem of the future, parents are in the driver's seat, not the education establishment.
Which is an educational freedom position.
It really is. It really is. And so the thing is that all of these things that they talk about in terms of damage to public education, et cetera, I mean, it's been disproven time and time again.
And the other places are thriving.
They're thriving. They're thriving. That's right. That's right. And you see, you know, especially in rural communities, new options opening up, because that's often an argument you'll hear is like, okay, well, say we pass school choice. That's great for the kids that live in the big urban centers. But what about those who live in rural communities where there aren't options? Well, that's the amazing power of innovation and technology. The age that we live in now is that there are high quality schooling options that can be delivered via technology in a micro school setting. There are many, many opportunities for our rural communities.
And it may open up whole new opportunities for people to take leadership to actually start schools that are thriving in those areas.
You know what's really interesting? There's actually a teacher who started a little school down in Beaufort doing the exact same thing. And so again, as we think about the power of choice, it's not just about the power of choice for parents and for students. It's a marketplace for teacher talent.
Well, you know, I mean, I worked with so many college students that were getting educational degrees, and not just from where I was, but from other schools. And the younger generation is very entrepreneurial and they're very visionary. I work with 20-year-olds. A girl that works with us, she just graduated from Clemson with a degree in L.Ed. They have a passion and a vision for education, and they really want to go out and make a difference. And I think you're going to end up, this is the way, it's the way things are moving.
Yes, it really is. And I'm so excited when I hear you talk about the vision and the missional purpose of the younger generation, because, you know, I think a lot about, you know, for our graduates coming out of Christian's colleges, you know, they may be called into missions work of some kind. And I just want to encourage them. There's mission work to be done right here in your own backyard. You don't have to go to a foreign country to be a missionary.
No, we had two guys that graduated with a degree in elementary education. They were both basketball players. And they set a vision to actually plant schools. And they bought a building up in Pennsylvania, and they were going to plant a school there together, and it was just a vision for education.
I love that.
And so, you know, I would love to see South Carolina start moving forward. yeah. in that area.
And this is the beauty of America, is that we have people from all faith perspectives, from all political party perspectives and philosophies, but we live in a pluralistic society, and our education system should be able to represent that pluralism.
Yeah, I think it's the way things are moving, yes. and we just need to get up to speed.
I agree.
Sounds like that. We know our governor and House Speaker were critical of the Supreme Court decision. What is the from your estimation, what is the best path forward to provide options? And what steps should listeners take to contact their state senators and representatives?
Yeah, well, I would love to see the court reverse its decision. And the governor and I will both be filing petitions to rehear the current case. I think that probably has a fairly slim chance of success. But what we do have going in our favor is that we have a newly composed Supreme Court since this decision has been issued. And so to me, the strongest and smartest path forward is to get new litigation in front of this newly composed South Carolina Supreme Court to have them remedy the very, very faulty reasoning
right.
of the majority's opinion in the Eidson case, which is the case.
So when do you see that happening?
Well, you know, that's the litigation track is harder to predict. But, you know, in terms of folks reaching out to encourage their state representatives and state senators to do something about this, I believe there are short term fixes that we can pursue, even potentially in a special session before the General Assembly comes back in January. And so those conversations are ongoing. And without, you know, compromising any confidentiality, I just want to convey that I have such a strong sense of urgency for these families that have been left in the lurch. This ruling was perpetuated in the most cruel, unjust way possible. If the court had any idea, well, first of all, the litigants in the case, the plaintiffs in this case, brought the case months after the General Assembly passed the bill. So they were late in filing litigation, which they knew they were going to file all along. So that protracted the timeline. And then the court, if they had had any inkling that they were going to do this to the program, could have enjoined the program from being implemented. They chose not to do that. And instead, they've ripped opportunity away from families in the middle of a school year, which to me is just unconscionable. And so we're doing everything we can to work with the General Assembly to figure out what the right pathway is to solve this, to get this back in front of the new court, and then also to provide assurance to these families. We've had some incredibly generous people who have said, hey, how can I help support these students? And so we're looking for vehicles to try to direct them to do that, because we have to take care of these kids and their families. They don't deserve this.
But even which I agree 100% with what you said, but that's a very small minority of people. And the reason I say that is that it seems a very small-mindedness towards what education is all about. And, you know, our whole society was changed 4 years ago with COVID. It changed everything. It changed the landscape. And in some ways, though it was difficult, it opened up whole brand new doors of opportunity. So it would seem to me that there is maybe a willful blindness to what could be happening in education, because South Carolina should be, I mean, this is my home state. I want people to look at South Carolina as a great educational option and not to be at the bottom of the barrel.
Right.
And if we're there, what do we have to do to make a difference? Leadership says, what do we have to do to fix this problem?
Yeah.
The job of a leader is to fix stuff.
That's right.
That's what we do.
Yep.
And if we really want our education to improve, insanity says just keep trying and doing it the same way.
That's right.
And to me, this seems like at least one of the ways that we can make the difference.
No, you're absolutely right about that. And in terms of South Carolina catching up with the times, I truly believe that the holdouts on our Supreme Court are kind of the last bastion of that old way of thinking. Our General Assembly, our governor has stepped up in big ways in order to push choice forward. And I'm confident that as soon as we get this legal wrinkle, which I view as a road bump, speed bump along the way, we're going to get to where we need to go. The question is just what the best path is to get there. So I'm encouraged, even though I was so disappointed by this, because there is commitment, I know, on my part and on the part of other leaders. And I think you're right. I think oftentimes in this choice conversation, people try to act as if those of us who support school choice think that school choice is the silver bullet for everything. And I want to be clear, that's not going to fix everything in South Carolina. So that's why I've spent my whole first year and a half refocusing instruction in our public schools around the science of reading, which is phonics-based instruction that we lost sight of in our public schools 20, 25 years ago. We're working right now on what we call the Palmetto Math Project, which is, again, laser focus on high quality instruction and instructional materials to get our math scores up. And so it's a multi-tiered task, but you're right. Leaders have to solve problems, and that's what we're trying to do every day.
So I'm sitting out there listening to you, and I'm going, okay, what can I do? What can a person do as we kind of wrap it up here? Just your average person, what can they do?
Well, I will start by saying pray. And I don't mean that in some kind of trite way, because I have personally felt the power of the prayers of God's people. And one of the most encouraging things is when I am out and about and somebody just comes up and pulls me aside and says, I just want you to know I'm praying for you. Yeah. I'm praying for our teachers. I'm praying for our students in our schools. So please pray. Pray that God will protect our schools from the violence that we have seen in other states, and that he will give us in South Carolina the strength and the courage to stand for what is right and to protect the hearts and minds of children here in South Carolina. You already mentioned something else in terms of know what's going on at the General Assembly. And Palmetto Family is a great way for your listeners to do that. So I know that you regularly are encouraging people to talk to their legislators, to pray for their legislators. So I really hope your listeners will recommit themselves to that work and to partner with you at Palmetto Family.
That's going to be one of our upcoming agendas as we look to the 2025-2026 legislative session. So
wonderful.
Thank you.
My pleasure.
I appreciate it. And we will pray for you, and we'll pray for your leadership, and we're excited that God has you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.